Thank you. So this is the third lecture, and this is going to be the most technical lecture. As you saw, the first lecture was jokes and stories, and the second lecture had kind of a more technical story, and this really we get into a bit more technical meat. There's going to be really non-trivial overlap between the lecture today and the lecture yesterday, and this is really intentional. So one is that if the material is new to you, then you heard it yesterday, you hear it today, and hopefully more will be remembered. But also I wanted this lecture to be self-contained. So if you weren't here before, this is a fully self-contained lecture. And if you really feel really bored during the first part, I will wake you up when we get to the new stuff. So I mentioned today this amazing connection between these two very different ways of thinking about logic. One is logic as a declarative formalism, which is the way most people think of logic, kind of a language in which you specify originally properties of mathematical structure, originally just arguments, and later on properties of mathematical structures. And then the new thing that started with Turing, which is thinking about computational models, that also was a branch of logic, and it's still recursion theory, still considered to be part of mathematical logic. And the surprising phenomenon is this very intimate connection between logic and automata. And again, I will review the canonical model, which is an atomistic fine set automata, beautiful little model. So it's a model for basically accepting or rejecting words. A word is a sequence of symbols. And the important thing is, I'm not mentioning the word finite, but everything is finite here. So we have a finite alphabet, a finite set of states, set of initial states, a non-deterministic transition function given a state and a letter, give you a set of possible successor, and the machine can choose among these successor non-deterministically. And finally, accepting states, given a sequence A0 to A-1 of input symbols, Iran chooses some initial state, chosen again non-deterministically from the set of initial states, and then follow the transition function. Transition function also gives a choice, and the machine chooses one of them, one of these states, and proceeds. And if the last state is accepting that the word is accepted, and here is the example of this little automaton, and now I think I can point. Wonderful. So you enter here, 0 always takes you back to the left, and 1 always takes you back to the right, and the red circle tells you this is an accepting state. So you accept here if the word ends with 1. So this is what he described, all the words end with 1. And this defines the class of regular languages, as I mentioned, very, very robust class of languages. And you can also look at the word as a mathematical structure. What is a mathematical structure? You need a domain and relations. So the domain here is the set of positions in the word. And you have one binary relation, which this compares between positions. And then we have a unary relation to tell us what letter is written in any given position. And once you have this, you use these atomic formulas, and you can write formulas and sentences. And here is a sentence that says there exists a position, such as for all other positions that are not to the right of this position, which means X must be the last position, and P sub A hold the text, it means that the last letter in the word must be X. And as I mentioned, you can add second order quantifier. We'll see an example in a little while of how you can make use of second order quantifiers. And the celebrated theorem, the so-called Bushi-Elgott-Trachtenbrod theorem, came up, but Trachtenbrod was a bit first. His paper came out in 57. Bushi and Elgott had an abstract in the notices later, just a couple of months later, again in 57. One abstract in the notices, two papers appear later. And I'm dying to know the story there, and I haven't found anyone yet who knows what was the story. They had one abstract together, then two separate papers. There is a good story there, I just need to find it. So what did they prove? They proved that these two very different looking formalism define the same class of languages, the class of regular languages. And the transition between one to the other is effective. So you're given an NFA and you want to write an equivalent sentence. you have to say there exists a run, and this you use, for this you use a second order quantifier, you encode the run as a, by predicates. Then you have to say that the transitions are proper, you start initial states, you follow the transition relation, you accept the, on the last run, this is all first order. What this I'll come back to it, why this is also important. The one that we're going to use a lot is inductive translation from MSO to NFA, and you do it by induction on a structural formula. You start from atomic formulas, they just look at the position, check that symbol A, symbol one is written there, and then you have to show closure under disjunction, which corresponds to union, and we know the logical, that regular logics are closed under union, and insertion quantification is essentially projection or homomorphism, and that's also closed, and complementation is negation is complementation, which is a bit trickier. And that really, so really the way it was done originally by Busch, Elgo, Trachtenberg, they work with deterministic automata. So for them, the difficulty was how to actually work with union and projection, and complementation was easy. I prefer today to work with NFA. So if we work with NFA, the complementation is a bit more subtle because there are now many possible runs and you have to say all of them are rejecting. So this was really shown by Rabin and Scott in 59, how you can go from, how essentially you can determinize a NFA. And the argument is that if you look at the run forest, you discover it has unnecessary duplication. So if you have at level I, you find the same state appearing more than once, you can collapse them into a DAG. And the DAG will have bounded width. And all you need to remember when you, the automaton has to now follow the levels of the DAG. And so here is now the Rabin-Scott construction. You use the power set to construct the new set, some people call the macro state. You start now the initial set, what was before a set of initial state, now it's a singleton, right? Because now it's the set consisting of the set of initial states. So now you have a unique starting state, and all the states that do not intersect the set of accepting states are accepting. And what you do here is kind of a collection. You start from a set, and you look at all possible successors, you get another set. And this gives you the complement. So this is NFA complementation. And as I mentioned before, this involved an exponential blow-up. And there's natural questions, can you do better than that? Is there any smarter way around it? The answer is no, you must, this is unavoidable. It's unavoidable because here I describe a world where the symbol, which is what happens here, you see there is a one, and n position letter there is a zero. So non-deterministically, this is very easy because you guess a position, you count to n, and you find you read a one, you count n steps, and then you check that there is a zero. And so you can do it non-deterministically. But to prove that this is not the case, to complement it, you have to essentially remember a window of length n. And there are 2 to the n possible worlds of length n. And you must remember what did you see. Therefore, you need exponential number of states. So this is unavoidable, and we will see that this is very significant. The basic decision formula given any descriptive formalism is that they describe anything. So for automata, it means given automaton that is describe any word, does it accept anything at all, or is it empty? If it's empty, it's not interesting. There is another problem, it can be too expressive, it can express everything. This is called the universality. If automaton accept everything, it's also not interesting. But I will ignore that problem here, that's a harder problem. And it really doesn't take all, it's an easy exercise to realize that it's enough to go to the graph of the automaton. And the graph of the automaton is in a graph that contains a directed graph, the set of states, and the edges are simply going to be all the pairs ST, such that you can go from S to T upon reading some letter A, all the possible transition of the automaton. And that's all you need to know. These are in some sense the topological structure of the automaton, and this is a very easy exercise. The automaton is non-empty if and only if there is a pass from initial to final states. So this is graph reachability, and this is something computer science we know how to do very, very well. This is almost the first algorithm in any graph algorithm course. This is probably the first algorithm. Now we go to the logic, and we want to do the same questions, which is the non-emptiness question. Now the question is given a sentence, is a set of models of the sentence non-empty? This is called the satisfiability problem. And again, this is the most fundamental question in logic. You can go to the dual of it, is it always true? But these two are introducible using negation. So on the face of it, if you look at the complicated sentence in logic, it's not even clear how you would start. But now we have a way, because we know you can transition from logic to automata. So if it's satisfiable, if and only if it describes a language, that language is non-empty, if and only if the automaton is non-empty. So this is the algorithm. Translate from logic to automata, and then check non-emptiness. Now we know that this is very easy. This is just graph reachability, so this is, must be the non-trivial part. And our algorithm on the face of it will have a non-elementary blow-up, because each time we have negation, we have to apply this again. Really, if you want to think about it, if you have alternation of quantifiers, I talked about the existential quantifier, you handle it by projection, but to handle the universal quantifier, you have to essentially dualize it and do complementation. And so if you have alternation of quantifiers, you'll have a power of exponential, and its height is alternation depth. And the question, really, people at the time did not think about it, because in the 50s, non-elementary was fine. Only later people start worrying. Generally, the more powerful computers, the more worried we are about complexity, right? At the time, recursive was good enough. And then finally, in 1974, Stockmeyer showed that, in fact, even first-order logic of a finite was non-elementary, in fact, even less than that. He showed that if you take regular expressions without star, but with complement, that's already, which is just concatenation, union, and complement, that's enough to give you non-elementariness. Amazing result. One of the really first results showing that we have a formalism that is decidable, very simple formalism, but highly intractable. And then in 1962, I mentioned yesterday this was inspired by questions by Church, Bushi extends the theory of automata on finite world to automata on infinite worlds. And to extend, he doesn't have to change the machine model. The machine model is exactly the model we had before. See, it's the same element, finite alphabet, finite set of states, initial state, transition function, accepting states, nothing is different. And the automaton works the same way. You feed it a sequence of symbols, and it starts in some initial state, and it chooses successor non-deterministically. And the only subtle part, really what Bushi had to invent, what does it mean to accept if the run is infinite? And Bushi just said, let's take a limit condition, and he said, you must visit F infinitely often. And this defines the class of omega regular languages. So today I have a little more time, so I will show you two examples. So this is the same automaton we saw before. You accept on the left, you start on the left, you accept on the right, 0 takes you to the left and 1 takes you to the right. So to accept, you have to visit here infinitely often, but you only get here if you see a 1. So this means that you must see infinitely many 1. Now this automaton is a little more interesting. What does it say? So you enter here. Now you can just stay here. You can stay here as long as you want. But if you stay there forever, you will not accept, because this is not an accepting state. To accept, you must eventually go to the right upon seeing 1. Notice here, 1 takes you back. 0 has no outgoing edge. So if you come here and you see a 0, you're stuck. So the automaton's abort. But if you see 1 from now on, then this is fine. So if you have a world with only finitely many zeros, then what do you have to do? You wait till you've read all your zeros, and then you stay here. And once you've read all the zeros, you make a transition here, and you stay here. I like this little automaton, because this is really, to me, the story of the human dilemma, so to speak. We have to make decision about things that will happen in the future. We don't know what's going to happen in the future. If we make the right decision, we'll be happy ever after. And if we make the wrong decision, we'll die a horrible death. In the same way that we say that a finite world can be viewed as a logical structure, an infinite world can be viewed as a logical structure. Again, what does it mean? It means we have a domain. The domain is now the set of all time points. We think of them as time points now, or positions. A binary relation to compare between positions. and a unary relation tell us which letter is which. And now we can write first order formulas using these atomic formulas, but also we can use second order formulas by quantifying. So now we can quantify over position. So now I'm going to give an example. We'll go slowly over it, show you the power of second order quantification. So I want to say that, let's say, Q holds at every even point, means point 0, point 2, point 4, etc. So how do I say that? I said there exists a set Q. And think of Q, I mean, I want Q to be the set of all even position. Okay, so at the end, I will say that if X is a position in Q, then little q must be true there. And now I need to make sure that the big Q is a set of all even positions. So I'm going to say the following. If X is in big Q and Y is a successor of X, and I'm writing here this plus one, but since you have order, you can express successor. So if Y is a successor of X, then Y is not in Q. And if X is not in Q and Y is a successor, then Y is in Q. And if X is zero, again, it's just a notation for saying it's the earliest point, has no predecessor. If X is zero, then X is in Q. So this forces Q to be the set of all even positions, and then I said that if X is in big Q, then little q is true at X, and therefore Q holds at all even positions. And we can actually prove that if you didn't have second order quantification, you will not be able to say this property. First order logic cannot count. And what second order logic adds us the ability to count. We've been talking a lot this week about ability to count. It's completely different ability to count. Don't get confused. So, and then Bushy in 1962 publishes a paper and he proved the same theorem. This is Bushy's theorem, and he proved that MSO over infinite words is equivalent to deterministic Bushy automata. They both define the class of omega regular languages, and the proof is just analogous. To say that to go from NBA to MSO, you quantify over runs, and you say they are accepting runs. In the other direction, it's an inductive proof. Union is disjunction is union. Essential quantification is projection. Negation is complementation. And here, Bucky has to earn his keep. Here is where he has to work hard, because the subconstruction is not going to work. And here is a very simple example where it doesn't work, is that you have these two automata, and they both have two states, S and T, and the alphabet is very simple. There's only one letter. So there's only one infinite word, 0 to the omega. So here you go here, and you spend here any amount of time, but then you go here and you stay here forever and you accept. If you go here, you can spend some time here, but then some point you try to accept, you go here, but then, as we say, horrible death, you die, you're stuck, there's nothing you can do there. So it forces you to stay here forever, and therefore you're going to reject. The subconstruction is not going to distinguish between these two automata. Subconstruction is good to tell us where have you arrived, but it doesn't keep the history of what you have done. So Bushy went on, and he managed to do it, really highly non-trivial, very difficult. I remember spending way back, this is 25 years ago, spending probably a month struggling with this paper. Just line by line, you know, like Stalingrad. And we conquered eventually the target. And then in 85, we were able to show that if you take really the construction of Bucky, but just implemented frugally, so to speak, you can do it with 6 into the n square. And we were very happy because this was exponential, but this is really, if you think that the exponential is bad, exponential is a piece of cake compared to 2 to the n square. I mean, just plug in, you know, n equal 10. Like 2 to the n is 1,000, okay, manageable, and 2 to the 100 is just astronomical number. So the quest started to see what we can do. And so it so happened that there was just a few years later, we had an improvement. Safra was showing that you can do it in n to the 2n, and Michel had n over e to the n, so at least we know it's somewhere in the neighborhood of 2 to the n log n. So we know by now it's harder than finite words. But to get really, it took over the years to many, many papers before, only in the last, basically here we finally were able to come up with a construction that was almost tight. Somebody was showing to show lower bound and eventually the upper bound. Now, this looks a bit strange, but we are very excited to get 0.97 n to the n, because at some point we thought maybe it's the number of trees, and that you have Cayley theorem, there will be n to the n. So to get 0.97 to the n, we told us this is not the number of trees. And then the next target was maybe it's the number of permutations. And this Lorban tells us, no, it's not the number of permutations either, because that would be n over e to the n. So it ends up some pretty ugly combinatorial function. Now again, the question we want to solve is a non-emptiness question, given now a Bush automaton that it accepts anything. And again, we go to the graph of the automaton, which are just considering states and transitions, ignoring the letters, the symbols. And if the lemma before said that what you need is to go from initial state to an accepting state, now we have just a slight variation of it. Again, it's an easy exercise. A is non-empty if and only if there is a path in the graph from the initial state to some accepting states, and then a lasso coming back to that state. And again, this is now you do what the difference is, you need to use depth-first search, because now it's about analyzing cycles in graphs. If you know a little bit about graph algorithm, that cannot be done using breadth-first search, but you need to use depth-first search. But again, this is linear time algorithm, very easy. And again, we go through the same idea, and this is really where the connection between automata theory and logic does the work. We want to solve the satisfiability problem. Given a sentence, does it have a model? And there's no direct way that we know how to do it other than translate to automaton and then check for non-emptiness. This is the algorithm. Okay, and this is a paradigm for many, many algorithms. We heard this afternoon, we hear about all these kind of meta-theorems, and they're all based essentially on taking some formula, translating it to an equivalent automaton. And again, we are going to get non-elementary growth. It's going to be 2 to the tower here, except here instead of having n, we'll have n log n. And again, this is the best we can do. This is non-elementary. You cannot do better than a unbounded tower of exponentials. Now, this is early 60s, like Bush's paper is 1962. And then, as time goes on in the 60s, people ask, can we push the theory farther? And in the mid-60s, people take the theory of automata on finite worlds and extend it to automata on finite trees. And then in 1969, Rabin publishes a paper, which really was a tour de force, and he's saying we can extend it all the way to automata on infinite trees. Okay? So what are infinite trees? So you can think, let's say, an infinite world, you can think of it either as a sequence of letters, or you can think of it as a function from the natural numbers to the alphabet. For any position, it gives you a letter. Now I'm interested in KRE3, and a label KRE3 will have to have a letter in every position in the tree. How do I identify a position in the tree? I have to show you which path I took from the root to the node. So this is the definition of a label infinite KRE tree. It's a function from 0 to the K minus 1 star to sigma. So as you go down, you choose my directions are 0 to K minus 1. So I go maybe 0, and then I take 1, and then maybe 2, and then back 0. I take a sequence of branches, and then I get to my node, and then it tells me what is the letter that's written there. So this is a labeled infinite tree. It's an extension of the concept of an infinite labeled word. And then Rabin, again, there was work done before him in the mid-60s extending to finite trees. And what do we do? So remember, the transition function told you, given a state and a letter, it gave you a set of successors. But now you have k children. So the idea is automaton will split itself into k copies. So the transition function needs to tell us how to go in every direction. So what is 2 to the s to the k? So s to the k is going to be all the k tuples. So a k tuple would mean go to maybe let's look at binary. Go to the left in this state and go to the right in that state. So you get a set of such tuples. So that means that the automaton make a choice, and the choice dictates how to go in every direction. Now, there's also how to define acceptance. Because now there is not one, even if you look at the run, it's not one run. The run is going to be also a tree. A tree has many branches, uncountably many branches. So we need some condition on that, and this becomes, again, more general, and I won't go there. But there is a notion of automata, in fact, very rich theory of automata on infinite trees. We can also take the logic and extend it to trees. The tree is a structure, and the domain is simply the set of all nodes in the tree, and we have unary predicates to tell us what letter is in a given position. But now, instead of having just successor or less than, we need actually k successor functions. So we have k relation telling us actually should be e0 to ek minus 1, just to be consistent. So you get a logic, and you can say very powerful things about trees. And Rabin goes to prove that, again, the tree MSO is the same as tree automata. So this the boss defined a set of infinite trees. And in fact, here I've done it with bounded branching trees. Rabin also did it with countable branching. You can even go and look at tree with countable branching. And if you look at the proof, and you realize that union is easy, because it's an deterministic automata, and projection is easy, and complementation is very, very hard. So if Bushi really had a very, once it's cleaned up, a very beautiful complementation, really to do complementation here, 69, it was really, I would say, only in the 80s, we finally kind of got a clean proof of complementation. This is, Rabin proof was really tour de force. And just as we've seen before, once you have the automata logic connection, you can solve the satisfiability problem. So this is called SNS or SKS or MSO on trees or S omega S. There are different names for this. And this is one of the most powerful decision techniques, the satisfiability techniques in mathematical logic. Essentially, if you look at all the satisfiability techniques, there are really basically two approaches. One is, I mentioned yesterday, was a bounded model property. Somehow show that you can search for models, but there is a bound on how big the models you need to have. Here there's no, I mean, here the models are infinite. But you find, using automata, you find finite representation. Essentially, you only have to search for finite representations. This is very, very powerful. And once this paper came out in the 60s, there was, during the 70s, many, many papers that show that all kind of logic are now decidable, always by reduction to MSO. And of course, all these results always come up with non-elementary complexity. So the beautiful result, not clear how useful they are because of this complexity. But again, this is really, to me, one of the canons of mathematical logic is Rabin theorem. And now we again leave this and we go back to New Zealand, Christchurch, New Zealand, where we meet Arthur Norman Prior, philosopher who is concerned about logic and ethics and religion. And he spent his time over his life. I have to say that I can understand going from Presbyterian to atheist, and even from atheist to agnostic, but I don't understand enough Christianity to understand why would you go from Methodist to Presbyterian. Maybe someone can explain to me the subtlety there. So, and the question that really bothers him is the questions of free will and how it makes no sense to have moral responsibility unless you have free will. In fact, this is a big dilemma when you read the Old Testament. Right? The Israelites want to leave Egypt, and so Moses goes to ask Pharaoh, let my people go. And what does God do? God hardens Pharaoh's heart. So Pharaoh doesn't let them go, and then he gets punished. Go figure. So how do we reconcile free will with either predestination, which means that God has determined how the future will unfold, and that seems clear that everybody thinks if God has decided, then I have no decision power, I have no free will, I'm just an automaton. And an attempt to reconcile it, who says, yes, you have free will, you can do whatever you want, except that God knows what you're going to do. And so in attempt to reconcile it, Prior went and invented the logic. He gives credit to one of his colleagues who really, he was way too generous. It was really his contribution. Other people talked before, you find reasoning about time going back to the Greeks. The questions of what does it mean when I say a statement, tomorrow there will be, they will talk about some naval battle. Tomorrow something will happen. What does it mean? What is the logical meaning of when I say something will happen tomorrow, when the future, if the future is not determined? So people have, William of Ockham is famous for also reasoning about time. But logic of time was due to Pryor. And his wife told the story how he came and woke her up, very excited, I've invented tense logic. Now, even the early philosopher realized there must be some connection to computers, either looking at time delay in computer circuits or application to processes. But this is really took a while before people really found that there is a way to do that, and this is really the person who gets credit for it, Zamir Pnu'eli, who in 1971 proposed to take temporal logic as a logic to use for specifying ongoing behavior of processes. And this was part of his realization that the way people were doing reasoning about programs, starting really from almost from 1960, so this is not, at that point close to 20 years, very much thinking about programs that when people were running programs on mainframes, and so you had you run a program and it did something. It got to some input, it maybe multiplied matrices, or solved PDEs, or computed DFT. And now in the mid-70s, people are starting to have microprocessors, and we're starting to have embedded systems, and the notion of transformational programs didn't seem appropriate anymore. Pnu'eli was struggling to find a way to talk about ongoing behavior, and by serendipity, he found tense logic, and he advocated using tense logic. And so the model that he has in mind is that you can describe every system as a graph. Okay, this is we have a workshop on really graph homomorphism. Every system is a graph, it's a labeled graph. How is that? Well, here is a system. What does every system have? Every discrete state system, I'll call it, has a set of discrete states. So we have a set of states. You can go from one state to another state, right? If I don't want to do it, but if I, here I did this, the machine changes state, right? And I went back, change state again. So the machine makes transition between states, so this is just an edge relation. Now, we want to label the states. I'll come back to fairness in a minute. We want to label the states because really the full set of the machine is not visible to me. For example, what's visible to me now is only about, about 1 million pixels. Actually, 3 million because there are 3 colors. So that's about 3 million pixels. So you can think of every pixel as a proposition. It's either lit or not lit. So that's 3 million propositions. And or at the level of the microprocessor, there are about maybe 600 pins, and every pin is high or low. So you can think of every pin as a proposition. So this is what we call observation function. So every state, it tells me which propositions are true. So this is a way to abstract how I'm communicating with this machine. Now, what is the notion of fairness? So there's a notion in computer science of worst case complexity. And you can apply the same idea to reason about system. You say, what will happen in the worst case? But people discover very quickly that the worst case is very pessimistic. That's why we call it the worst case. But if you're that pessimistic, you really cannot prove anything about anything, right? Because in the worst case, none of us will survive the night because a meteor will hit Toronto, okay? And, it will be whatever, a new extinction wave, etc. Most of us think that the odds of this are pretty slim, and we're not going to be too scary going to sleep thinking we will wake up tomorrow morning. And the same, imagine now you're trying to reason about communication in this computer, and we reason about what's called non-reliable channel. Non-reliable channel is a channel that if you send a bit, there is some probability the bit will not get across. And there's always such probability because there always could be some quantum fluctuation and the bit will not get across. So in the worst case, you're trying to send a message, I'm hitting the keyboard. In the worst case, I keep hitting and nothing ever happens because there is this Maxwell demon, and each time I hit the key, the demon says, nope, not this bit, and it would never arrive. So we have to make some assumption on reasonableness. And fairness is a whole rich area that I will just touch on it very briefly. To make assumption of reasonableness, you assume, for example, look, the channel will be up infinitely often. So if I keep hitting enter, eventually it will go through. So this is some assumption of benignness on this malevolent universe. And so we assume that there is some notion of states, and on an infinite computation, you'll visit the first state infinitely often. Now, a graph is just a static description. What we have in mind is that that you will run the machine. What does it mean to run the machine? It means you start in some initial state, and then you follow edges, and in each point you get a snapshot, you get an observation of the system. And so this is the run, is the actual sequence of states, and this is what you're going to be visible. Think of it as the set of traces. So the set of infinite words, in some sense, is the full description of what this machine is capable of doing. So you can say that it's really not important to me to know what really happened inside the machine. All I need to know, what are the possible behavior of this machine? What are the possible observable behavior of this machine? And if I know the sort of observable behaviors, I know everything there is I need to know about this system. And in particular, if you take out, let's say, the microprocessor, which is Intel in this machine, and you plug in an AMD processor, as long as the traces are going to be the same, I will never know the difference, except for the cost. So that means that we want a logic to reason about linear computation. So I talked yesterday about linear time versus branching time, but here I will not get into that debate. We will just stay right now, stay with linear time. And we want to say things like this. No two processes can be in a critical section at the same time. It's a bad idea if two processes are trying to write to the same position in memory. But I also want to say that things do happen. The computation does make progress. Every request is granted. Now, one way to think about it is, let's suppose you have a question in a lecture. So we do have a protocol. The protocol, you have to raise your hand, and then I will say, yes, what's your question? So I will grant you your question. Now, if I look at Libor, then I probably do not see the people over there. So they can raise their hand, and I will not see it. So it's not quite true that each time you raise your hand, your request will be granted. So maybe we need to have a bit more specific protocol, and what we want to make sure is that if you keep your hand in the air, then eventually I will notice, because I try to scan the room, and eventually I will notice you, and your request will be granted. So this we'll have to write is every continuous request is eventually granted. But if you keep your hand in the air, you'll discover that the blood starts coming down, and the lactic acid start to build up, and after about 5 minutes, it's going to be a bit unpleasant, and 10 minutes is going to be maybe too long. So maybe this is not very good. Maybe you want this one. Every repeated request is eventually granted. You just have to keep raising your hand. Now, somehow you all managed to get to this point without ever taking the raise your hand protocol and specifying it in detail. Somehow we muddle along. But if whenever every time I come here, and my big worry is this machine has to take to the projector, and they have to synchronize, and they have to go through something like this, and I'm almost nervous it won't happen because it sometimes doesn't happen. So if you want to specify such a protocol, you have to be very clear how is the protocol supposed to behave. But it's not enough to say this in English, and I'm assuming that no other language is superior to English in that respect. There's always some ambiguity, and we want something very rigorous to say it, and this is where temporal logic comes in. So temporal logic was simply taking propositional logic and adding temporal connectives such as next, we're assuming the time is discrete, so next, and eventually, and always, and until, and we have this nice picture that tells the semantics. So here, this is the semantic, it says a trace pi at point W, and this means satisfies this formula, and here's the picture. You're here, and phi will have to be true in the next state. And to satisfy phi until side, this is the picture, phi will have to be true and true and true and stay true for a long time maybe, until eventually psi is true. So this is it, there's no bound here, it doesn't tell you when thing will happen, it just promises you eventually they will happen. So now we can go back and write all these properties in temporal logic. Now you may have seen temporal logic before, and so temporal logicians usually write G's and F's and X's until, or boxes and diamonds and circles. But one of the things I've learned from my industrial experience was use English. It is much better to even write logic, because these are all formulas, except they almost read like sentences in English, right? So this is always not CS1 and CS2. And this is always request implies eventually grant. And this is always request implies request until grant. Which means if you make a request, then you must keep your hand in the air until the request is granted. It does promise you that it will be granted, but it doesn't tell you how long you have to keep your hand in the air. And this basically says always eventual request means if you repeatedly request, then your request will be granted. So now we have a way of taking this property and write them in a way that is very rigorous and very precise, there's no ambiguity. This is really a huge contribution of logic to computer science that people do not always quite understand. I mentioned yesterday why logic is so important to computer science yesterday and the day before. Logic was designed as a language of mathematics, not really the language for computer science. But the way it evolved, it has to be a language with the utmost precision and no ambiguity. That's the way people wanted to have mathematical statements that have no ambiguity. And when dealing with computers, we need a formalism that has clear meaning and no ambiguity. And this is where logic comes into computer science. Now, what is the expressive power of this logic? So, as you know, there is a history of Hans Kamp in 68, but I will skip it and just say that in 1980, Gabay, Pnuli, Shelach, and Stavi prove that provisional LTL has precisely the expressive power as first order logic over the natural. Now, one direction is actually very easy. If I want to go from LTL to first order logic, this is actually very easy. What I have to do, I can do it by induction. So here, let me just show you how I will take the until, and I will show you how you take the until and translate to a first order formula, and I'll write the formula is true at point X. So remember, what is phi until psi? It's at some point psi will be true. So I said there exists some y greater than x, and inductively translate psi to FO, and this will be true at point y, and for every z between now and y, theta will be true. So this is really, if we go back to the picture, oops, what happened here? I need to go back. You see, we have, I need to say phi is true until psi is true. So there is a point, and there is a point where psi is true, and until then, phi must be true. And this is very easy to set in first order logic. So inductively, it's very easy to go from LTL to FO. It's a translation with linear blow-up. The other direction is actually non-trivial and getting, you know, you can do it using going from LTL to NBA, but doing going from first-order logic to LTL is actually non-trivial. But one corollary from this is if I want to translate LTL to automata, I can do it very easily. I'll go from LTL to first-order logic, and then I will invoke Boothby's theorem, and I'll go for first-order logic to automata. So the translation to first-order logic immediately gives also a translation to automata, except it's non-elementary. Because if I do this translation, I will end up with alternation of quantifiers, and as you remember, if I have unbounded alternation of quantifiers, my translation, my tower of exponential gets taller and taller. So once we had this result, it was immediately consequence was you can translate LTL to automata, but with a non-elementary blow-up. And then what happened in a couple of years, that people discovered, people was Pierre Wolper and myself, that we can actually go from LTL to automata in one exponential. And I said, once you had to get used to non-elementary, one exponential is terrific news, wonderful news. This is kind of the best you can do. So now, for example, if we want to do LTL satisfiability, we have an exponential algorithm, and this really we must use this translation to basically to get practical verification tools. They all build on this translation, and we would not have white producers industry if we didn't have it. That theorem really was the key. But the question is, how did it happen? I mean, we described before this beautiful inductive translation from MSO and from first order logic to automata, and you can try to do the same thing to LTL. You can try to translate from LTL to automata inductively, and you're going to get the same non-elementary blow-up. And here is where games come into the picture. So, and what we're going to do, we're going to take the notion of automata, we're going to extend it. So right now you can think of it, of a non-deterministic automaton as a one-player game. Why is it a one-player game? There is a war there. And the automaton plays solitaire. Why? Because the automaton has to make choices, but it's just up to the automaton. automaton, if the automaton will make the right choice, she will win the game. So I want you to think normally when I have a transition function, and I say if you are in state S and you read A, you can go to T1, you can go to T1 or T2 or T3. Usually I just write, it's the set T1, T2, T3. But you could write it in this syntax to make it very clear that you make a choice and the choice is up to the automaton. But once you realize that you're using a logical notation, you can say, what happens if I write this? I say, if you're in S and you read A, the condition becomes T1 and T2 or T3. And this means you must accept both from T1 and T2 or from T3. So now you put logical conditions there, and it would mean that the transition would be not to, normally you are in a state and you make a transition to get only a single state. But that means that you'll have to make a transition from S to both T1 and T2, or to T3, because you must accept from both T1 and T2, or from T3. So now we're getting an automata where if you have a state and a letter, the condition is a positive Boolean formula over the set of states. This is an example of a positive Boolean formula. I just need to mention that this is one way of doing it in terms of Boolean formulas, and it's very convenient here. There's another way of doing it, which is using existential state and universal states. And this is due to Chandra Kos and Stockmeyer in a beautiful paper called Alternation from 1980. And they explicitly have this notion of two different type of states. And I prefer to use this notation, we'll see in a minute why. So formally, what is an alternating automaton? And this formalism is due to Brzezowski and Lice, and they call it Boolean automata. I'm kind of obfuscating terminology. So everything as we had before, except transition function, is given a state and a letter. It's a Boolean, positive Boolean formula. And what is the meaning of this? Now there is no run, it's a game. What is the board? The board of the game is the input word. So A0, R1, etc., this is the input word. The position in the game is a configuration of the game, or position in the game is a point in the world and a state. So you start at state A0 at point 0. At the beginning, you're at the start of the world, and you're starting from state S0. So now, what happened? There is this transition function. It's a Boolean formula. The automaton has to choose a set of states that will satisfy this Boolean formula. So if I go back to the previous one, if this is the formula, to satisfy it, you have to choose both T1 and T2 or T3. You choose a set of states that satisfy the formula. So this is the move by the automaton. So the automaton chooses a set T of states that satisfies the formula. And essentially it says, I can accept from any one of these states. Now the opponent says, wait a minute, I'll challenge you. I'm choosing one of these states. And I say, okay, let's show me how you can accept the rest of the world, go to position I plus one, and accept from the state T. So automaton always make a claim, I can accept from a set of states, and the opponent points at the set of states and says, okay, show me from here. So it's a game between the automaton and the opponent. And to win, first of all, this is an infinite game, so for a play to win, you must visit an accepting set infinitely often. Same definition we had before. But to accept a word, the automaton must have a winning strategy. It's not enough that you, by luck, you had some kind of a play and you won. You must win against all possible moves by the opponent. It's a winning strategy. So this is not the notion of acceptance. So this is, I know this is a bit much to absorb quickly, so let's do one example. This is a very simple game. So that there are really two states. We'll call them master and slave. Maybe servant, better, master and servant. And the alphabet is 0 and 1. And let's see what happens. You start at the initial state is master. And let's see how they behave. So when the master sees 1, it says, you know, I'm satisfied. So it just goes to the next state, at state M. But if the master sees 0, it continues, but it launches another process called servant. So I have now to accept from both M and S. So the master always continues, but it launches a separate process each time it sees a zero. Now let's see what does the servant do. When the servant sees one, the Boolean condition is true. To satisfy true, you need to do nothing. True is satisfied immediately, and essentially the servant quits. The servant is done. But if the servant is zero, it continues. So what's happening here? The master is trying to see once. Each time he sees a zero, it launches a servant process. The servant will keep going until it sees a one. And if it doesn't see one, it will be just stuck. It will go forever. Now, the set of accepting states, only the master is accepting state. That means if the servant gets stuck, now I cannot win, because I'm going to have, once the servant is stuck, it is stuck forever, because it never will see one. So essentially, the language here is simply all the words that have infinitely many ones. So, of course, we saw before how to do it using non-determinism, but I want you to show an example here how you can also do it using a game. So you see, it's all conjunctive. There's no disjunction here, but I can do it in this fashion. This will be fine. So this will stay here forever, and this is accepting. Yeah. In fact, remember, the servant is not an accepting state. So each time I see seven, I must get out of there, which I must see a one. Now, what is the expressiveness of this formalism? Turns out that non-deterministic Boolean automata accept all the omega regular languages. And alternating automata, these are called alternation Boolean automata, they define precisely all the omega regular languages. You gain nothing in expressiveness. So what's the point? Succinctness. Turns out that these are exponentially more succinct than the non-deterministic automata. So first of all, Miyano and Hayashi in a paper in 84 show us that there is exponential translation from alternating automata to non-deterministic automata, and not too difficult to show that this is the best you can do. So we saw before that non-emptiness for non-deterministic automata was just a graph search, so it was in linear time. What about non-emptiness for alternating automata? So the answer is, really, the only way we know how to do it, essentially, translate to non-deterministic automata and then do the search. The translation is exponential, so on the face of it, it seems that this will be an exponential algorithm, but you can be a bit clever about how to use space, therefore this is in polynomial space. But essentially, translation is just translate to non-deterministic automata and do a search over there. Now, why is this useful? Because in 1994, I was able to show that if you start from LTL formula, you can go to alternation Boolean automaton with linear number of states. So to go from formula to automata now, it's a linear translation. So if you take this linear translation and combine it with this, you get essentially a p-space satisfiability procedure. Start with your formula, translate to Boolean automaton, and then run a non-emptiness test, and you get it's going to be in p-space. So the question is how suddenly, before we talk, remember we started with non-elementary translations, then I talk, the good news is I get exponential translation, which essentially you get from this plus Miyano Hayashi. But how do you get a Boolean, a linear translation? So the idea is that, and this idea apparently goes back to Lorentzian in 58, and then Jaakko Hintikka was a big pusher for it, something called game semantics. And he argued that you should think of game semantics also for first order logic. And you can think of, people talk about the two quantifiers, A and E. So people talk a game between Abelard and Eloise. But this is will be a very tragic game, so I prefer to use protagonist and antagonist. So let's see now, let's take this idea of game semantics and apply it to LTL. So how should you think about it? What's happening? I have a formula phi. I have an infinite word. This is the model. I'm going to play a game to prove that the formula is true. And a position in the game will be a formula and a point in the world. So initially I have to show that phi holds at point zero. So how does the game proceed? Well, if it's a propositional formula, then I need to look at the current truth assignment and say is it true or not. Okay? So in this case, propositional formula is going to be very easy to see, it's just is it true or not. Suppose it's a disjunction. If it is disjunction, the protagonist will choose which of the subformula to satisfy. It's a disjunction. I'm going to choose which one to try to satisfy. If it's a conjunction, I have to satisfy both. So the antagonist will choose which one to satisfy. If it's a next formula, actually it doesn't matter because we just have to go and check. I say protagonist move to the next. You take the theta in the next time point, point I plus 1. But I could have said antagonist move because it's deterministic move. It doesn't matter who moves. What about until? So what happens? Remember, until means that eventually chi will be true, and until then theta is true. How do I translate it into a game? It means the following. Either chi is true now. I can say, I think chi is going to be true now. So I will make a transition to chi at point I, and chi will have to be true now. Or I said, you know what? I think I can postpone. How do I postpone? I have to prove, I will argue that theta is true now, but next psi is the same formula, will be true in this point, which means I will have to continue and to try to satisfy the until formula in the next time point. Now, of course, when you look at this, you say, wait a minute. He's going to be able to postpone this forever. But here we will have, remember, we have a notion that something must happen infinitely often, and we will block you from saying mañana forever. Right? So we don't be able to postpone it forever because something we will block you from repeating something infinitely often. So the idea here now we're going to take this semantics, we're going to alternating automata to capture this game. Because alternating automata really, remember, it's just a game. So here is now the automaton, and here is a full translation. It's a bit dense, so don't worry if you don't fully comprehend all the details, but let's try to go through it nevertheless. So the formula is phi. So sub f of phi is all the subformulas of phi, and I'll write non u of phi, all the non-until subformulas. So what is the automaton? The alphabet is simply all the truth assignments. The state are simply all subformulas. The initial state is the initial formula. I will define in a minute transition function. And the non-until formulas are accepting. All the other formulas are not accepting. So you cannot be stuck at an until formula. This is what we're going to prevent you from happening. So what happened? If you're in a proposition and you read truth assignment, it's either true or false. So your condition is true, it means you accept now. Once you hit a false, you can never accept. If it's a conjunction, you simply say, okay, I will satisfy both conjuncts. If it's disjunction, you simply write this, I will satisfy both disjunct. If it's a next phi, this is just short for next phi, next psi, you read it and you go to check psi in the next letter. And this is where all the hard work is done. If you see xi until psi, then either psi is true now, so you simply switch to the acceptance, the function for psi, or xi must be true now, and in the next state, the initial formula must be true. So here I'm looping back to the same formula. So this is the only place where I have a cycle. Everything else simplifies the formula. The formula gets simpler and simpler, except until I have a cycle. And I might get stuck here, except that this is not an accepting state. So if I get stuck here, I will reject. The only way to not get stuck here is eventually to satisfy the until. So I just want to give you again the flavor. I know that this is a bit hard to follow in one lecture, but the idea is that we took our notion of automata and we made it more powerful by essentially going from solitaire, non-deterministic automata can be viewed as a solitaire game, and now we move to a two-player game, and it gives us much more power. And it's still a game as an acceptance mechanism. It defines a language. And what we also know that this is, everything I've shown here was for words, but the whole thing can be extended to trees. So Kupferman, Wolper, and myself, we showed that you can do the same thing for CTL. So I mentioned yesterday CTL, it's a branching time formula, and it reasons about trees, and there is a translation from CTL to bushy tree automata, again with linear blow up. And how do you check emptiness of of alternating Bushy tree automata. Well, first you have to translate them to non-deterministic Bushy tree automata, and you do this, there is an exponential translation, and it was already known you can check non-emptiness of Bushy tree automata in quadratic time, and so together this gives us, for example, now a very clean exponential algorithm for satisfiability of CTL. Okay, so adding the games was a critical step, games and via alternating automata was a critical algorithmic step to get optimal algorithm for temporal logics. So this brings us close to the end. I try to make the following points. One is that we have a very, very powerful paradigm connecting logic and automata, two different types of way of doing logic, and they're intimately related. And the thing that comes out of it is algorithms. We get algorithms now that we just wouldn't have otherwise. And again, this has now become part of the background. In the previous lecture, we heard about meta-algorithms. And the thing that underlies all of this start from logic, connect to automata. I mean, I think it wasn't even mentioned. Daniel didn't mention it, but it was just obvious. This is the way you have to do this. And the new element that really just was came in the last roughly 15 years is the whole idea of eddy games and alternating automata to give us a richer formalism and a way to get more optimal algorithms. And this is still very much the connection between logic, automata, games, and algorithm, still a very fertile research area. And let me, as you may have noticed, I like to pontificate a little bit and I have the podium. So I think there is a really very important philosophical idea here. So I think one of the most fundamental ideas in science, if not maybe the most, is what are called Tower of Abstractions. So science deals with just incredibly complicated phenomena, and we do it by being very resolute about focusing on what we're focusing right now and abstracting everything else. So if you look at the physical sciences, right, then if you're a string theorist, then you only care about strings. But then if you do, you know, what's called chromodynamics, quantum chromodynamics, you try to think how do strings give rise to quarks. But once you're at the level of hadrons, you don't care about strings anymore. You only care about quarks. And from hadron you get atom, from atom you get molecules, from molecules you get maybe amino acid genes, genomes, organism populations. And every point we need to reason just about one layer, and the layers below it get abstracted away. And we do the same thing in computer science. We start from analog devices, which is still, I consider, to be electrical engineering. And then we abstract away the analog aspect, and we get digital devices, where computer science starts. And then we build microprocessors, and then assembly languages, and higher-level languages, and libraries, and software frameworks, and now people talk about ecosystems. Every time we go to a higher level of abstraction. And we do this because this is the only way we can deal with complexity. Right? Imagine that each time you go to the computer, you'll have to see the bits of the BIOS. Right? You will be just drowning in details. And one of the things we've done in computer science is also we have built abstract components for algorithms. So I could just tell you breadth first search, and assuming that at least most of you have some exposure, it's an abstract building block now, and I don't have to go and give you the details of how to do that. Or I can say DFS, and it's the same thing. So I want to propose here that games give us even yet a higher level algorithmic building block. So if I tell you, you know, of course you can go underneath and you say you're going to implement, you have to worry, it's really how do you solve a game? There is a game tree and you have to go up and down the game tree and solve it, but this is very messy. But the idea, again, think of it as an abstraction. I can say, okay, this is just emptiness problem for alternating Bushy automaton, and now it's one can imagine there is a library that implements it, and it's just become yet another building block. And so I think we need more such high-level building blocks, and I think alternation / games is the building blocks that I would like to promote. Thank you very much.